So yesterday we had a one-day sitting, and I started talking, started, as Karen said, a conversation. Actually, I'm doing all the talking. that I'm going to continue tonight and tomorrow night, because it's on my favorite all-time topic. Now, I have a lot of pet topics. Suffering is one of them. But this body-to-body consciousness thing has really got me. And I've been thinking about it a lot. And so yesterday, our sitting really emphasized body awareness. We did lots of movement in the sitting. We took a walk around town in single file. And that ability to have direct, immediate experience was not mediated by concept is what we started studying yesterday. So I would like to talk some more about it tonight. And then we'll have some time after for you to ask questions. That's why I ended our sitting a few minutes earlier, because questions are very helpful for me. So, you know, there's lots of suffering in this form world. I don't have to tell you. We all suffer tremendously. And we know of suffering. If we're not suffering right this minute, we know of someone or some group of people who is. And one thing after another happens. In our world and in our lives. And when you begin absorbing suffering blow after blow after blow, you understand that you have to decide what is important in your life. What really has to be focused on in order to make it through. In order to, in the midst of the worst circumstances, be the as generous and kind as you can possibly be, even though your life is miserable. So the suffering that, well, 2005 was a bad year for a lot of people. And in it, because of all the suffering, I got very reacquainted with what is very important to me. One is appreciation of what is here now and the vow to settle into it again and again. I've been sitting for about 35 years, but you have to keep vowing to settle into this. You have to keep doing it. And I personally had a lot of help with this particular task. I've had years of taking my body's point of view, which is what we did yesterday. And what I mean by my body's point of view is being mindful of my bodily sensations and my sense impressions. This is the body's point of view. It's an immediate, direct experience, your body. So when we talk about intuition, as we often do, we're actually asking for that wisdom that the body is privy to. And as you get more and more refined in body, in what your body perceives, you realize the tremendous connection there is with not only other people, but other things as well. So my body is willing to be wholeheartedly sad, hysterical, outraged, restless, fearful. And it's taught me that all of this passes of its own accord eventually. Maybe not the disease that you have or the injury you sustain, but your first impressions of those catastrophes do pass. Your first impressions pass. Maybe not the bad news, but your first appraisal, your first point of view about the bad news passes. So my job is to pay attention to my reaction to bad news. That's what I've set out as my job. And when I do pay attention, I often notice that as doors are closing, other doors are opening. And there's so much comfort in the present if only we become aware of it. And as practitioners, that's our job, to become aware of the stuff that's in the present that gives us the courage and energy to go on and present this whole world with an alternative to fundamentalism and materialism. It's such a thankless job to represent this point of view, so you can't be looking for thanks. You have to find your sustenance and source of energy in what's right here. And for comfort and joy, nothing beats this body-to-body contact and connection with other beings and other objects. Perceiving the infinitely expansive support of spoons and pillows and chairs and microwaves. This is a very supportive universe, this man-made universe. A spoon is made for us, our mouths. You can eat more soup with a spoon than you can your fingers. So to be able to settle into that and appreciate it is tremendously comforting. So I'm reminded of the story of the Tibetan Lama who, after he'd lived a full and rich life, offered his body to whatever microbes and viruses and demons might have use of it. So he laid down. He laid down to die as the projected result of this intention to offer his body. And all these predators did indeed come and visit him. He didn't keep up his health. He didn't eat. He didn't do things that were wholesome and healthy. He just offered his body. Whoever wants it can have it. I've lived a rich, full life. But he lived at least another decade as their host, and he died happy. So this story, when I was first told it several years ago, abruptly changed my attitude toward being flesh, being ill, and dying. Because basically I realized from that story how I'm just a body among bodies. And some of the bodies around me will benefit from feasting on me. And as a priest, I have a little post-it on my forehead saying, "Feast on me." I didn't realize. So, but to tell you the truth, having lived now some years as a priest and having resisted it for many decades, I didn't know it would be so helpful, or I would have done it a long time ago. I didn't know it would be so helpful to people to have this posted on my forehead. It makes me feel very ashamed of myself and so self-indulgent that I resisted this so long, becoming ordained. But that's another lecture, another story. So I feel now like my agenda is to teach the Dharma and to enjoy other people's company while I'm at it. But that's only a plan. You know, it's very similar to the plans that anybody makes, to get strong by exercising or to get rich, you know, by investing in business practices or to save the world, you know. It's just like any other plan. From the body's point of view, those plans are superfluous. Anything laid on merely breathing and dying is extra. So in my own day-to-day life, this is obvious to me, not an abstraction, because I'm aging very rapidly. And this undercuts my attempts to keep my disease, rheumatoid arthritis, at bay. For years, I was able to keep the pain and stiffness of my disease under control by eating properly and doing exercises. I never had to take drugs, let alone those arthritis drugs which compromise your organs. I never had to do that, but as I aged, you know, the past 5 to 7 years or so, I saw that I was going to have to exercise full time. That the aging process was compromising my ability to keep it at bay, so I started taking arthritis medicines then to help. They developed new ones that don't compromise the organs. They have other problems, but... So I had to get help. So that was a lot of information for me to realize my great regime was not enough. But also, not only am I aging rapidly, but many interfering things could happen with my plans to hang out with you guys and teach the Dharma. And my lifestyle makes them more probable. I drive a lot. And much of it is at night and on weekends. And I live in a town which has a lot of drunks in it. It's a resort town. So often when I'm driving home on a Saturday night, I'm really dodging like a video game. And so this is humorous to talk about, you know, but it's really scary. When you're actually doing it. And one night a couple months ago, I had a blowout on 101 North, and, you know, they happened so fast, I couldn't get over to the side, so there I was in the, you know, on the right-hand, I got over to the right-hand lane, but there I am, you know, it's dark, put on the flashers and everything, and I even put on my inside lights, so I could be well seen. And just as it was all dimming, the AAA guy showed up and got me off the freeway. So I was lucky, but that was pretty dramatic for me. So I also fly frequently, you know, to teach in New York and Washington and blah, blah, blah. So I'm one of those airline passengers that giggle nervously when they tell you about flotation devices. You know, oh, just take your seat and hold on to it, you know, if we crash into the ocean. So, also because of the people I love and my own inclinations, I'm often in neighborhoods where to be an arthritic old lady is not a good idea. So all these things conspire to, you know, realize how tenuous my situation is. A lot of things could interfere with my teaching. My son could die, and I would have to take on his son and raise his son. So a lot of things could interfere with my hanging out with you guys. But I am ready to live any of these lives wholeheartedly, with humor and the consolation of warm bodies and spoons and pillows. I'm ready to live any of those possibilities. Loss is as immediate as breakfast to me. I know how to get wrenched off center by grief and pain and come back, just like a bozo doll. I know how to do that, to breathe and release. So Yunmen, who was a famous Zen master of the classical period, about 900 to 1200. Is that right, Brian, those years? Oh, okay. You sent me the CD. Anyway, Yunmen was a famous Zen teacher, and he said, "In the universe, there's a treasure that is hidden in this heap of flesh. It holds up the lantern and goes inside the meditation hall. It brings the monastery gate to the top of the lantern. It brings the monastery gate," you know, those things were huge. The monastery gate had to keep out bandits, you know, high and huge. "It brings the monastery gate to the top of the lantern." That's like saying, this is a force so powerful it brings all the cars in the parking lot and puts them right here. Puts them right here, a force so powerful that it does that. So the heart of this koan is that the heap of flesh itself is the treasure. This heap of flesh itself is the treasure. This body is the body of the Buddha. And as Buddhists, we all believe this, whether we understand it or not. All of Buddhism, every school of Buddhism, is to return us to this, this body, and this experience. All, every school, is to return us to this experience and this body. But Yunmen's teaching has nothing to do with understanding, nothing to do with believing. It has to do with reality. This reality, and we have, you know what, 80 different realities in this room going on right now. And we have all this to choose from, all this and each other to choose for our reality. And the more refined your consciousness gets, the more all of these details infiltrate. And you can feel your body feeling it all, not just the other people, but the things on the wall, the wood, everything about this room. We're aware of it all. And the more you can clear out some space from your own agenda, the more refined, the more you notice. So this is what our practice is about, this kind of noticing. And to realize our own perfection, the way that perfection is manifesting right now, right here, just as we are, what we're looking for, we already are. We have to notice it and appreciate it. It's just waiting there for our embrace. So Yunmen's treasure is the truth of the nature of self, and that is that you can't put your finger on a self. There's just these aggregates, these skandhas, form, feeling, perception, thinking, and consciousness. There's just, if you slow down enough, you just realize there's no unifying principle. It's just this experience, then this experience, then this experience. There's no need to unify them. If you slow down enough, you have these discrete experiences without pulling them all together. So self is just our experience. Just our experience. It's only a perceptually shifting aggregate, collection of experiences. It's not fixed. And we're always trying to escape this because it's so chaotic. It's more than we can stand. So we try to pull it together with some ideas to just calm it down a little. Because if you look at your life from breath's point of view, it's just too much going on. And it's chaotic. It doesn't mean anything. It's just an experience. It panics us because there's no guaranteed safety. We're horrified by how truly vulnerable and permeable we are. So we try to define ourselves by what's out there. You know, I and you. But mostly I want or I hate. So we define ourselves by these things. So Jungmann is leading us home to see that and resolve the question of this perceived separation. He's shattering our intellection. You know, the gates on top of the lantern. Our belief systems, the way that we define ourselves, they're all helpless before the wording of that koan. It doesn't make sense. It forces us into some other mode of being. So what's left after the shattering of the intellect? Just this. Just sitting in this experience, this mystery, this don't know. This don't know is excruciating for us control freaks. The fact that we're sitting right here and we don't know, we try to carry it forward in our minds, but we don't know. We don't know what will happen. So, let's see, I want to skip some of this because I'm getting restless. So we only have eyes to look at things now. In reality, this is all we know at any one time, right here. I hope you're happy right here because this is it, right here. You can't, you know, say, well, that was a bust, I'll go turn on the TV. It's right here, right here. And so our job is to manifest truth as this body. Don't wait till you're healthy. This mind, don't wait till you're not neurotic. Do it with this, with what you have right now. It changes the next moment anyway. You might as well start right now. So at first, practice takes a lot of effort. A tremendous amount of effort because we're not used to being mindful, especially if it's boring. So we have to penetrate the boredom, and it takes a lot of effort. But as you get used to being mindful and you get pleasure from being mindful, it gets easier. It actually gets easier, and mindfulness becomes a companion, a comfort, a richness, another dimension to your life. So it just becomes a part of your life. You just drive, you just walk, you just hit the bells, you just play an instrument, trusting and entering that not knowing. I like to call it finding comfort in the free fall itself. We're just free falling. And it takes a tremendous amount of stability to find comfort in the free fall, to just tumble over head over heels forever, and to find comfort in that. There are comforts in it. So it doesn't matter what religion you choose or what beliefs you have. Basically, you just have to develop the stability to sit still in the middle of chaos and confusion. So the question that's interesting to me is not how do I get enlightened, or how do I have peace of mind, or not even how do I accept myself the way I am. You know, I've had many theories of what practice is about since I started. My first theory was that it was just a magical process. You just got your rear end on a cushion and the universe would take care of it. So that's how I probably did that for about 10 years. And then my next theory was that it was about balance. You know, the middle way and all that, so you wouldn't be too hateful, and you wouldn't be too kind, and you just find this balance someplace. And, you know, extend that out in all directions, like just the right amount of exercise, the right amount of society, the right amount of isolation, or, you know, the balance thing is really, because you feel so good if you start to live that way, it's tricky. You really do think it's it. It's not it. And then my next theory was that it was a self-acceptance. If I could totally accept myself the way I am, that would be peace of mind. And it makes perfect sense, right? Because then you wouldn't worry about it. You would just be yourself and your practice would be kind of seamless. So that actually, that's a very interesting theory. Well, the implications for your practice are very interesting. So you find out what you trust. So I had that theory for a long time. And now I'm just kind of back to the magical. I think I was right the first time. But all these theories take you along interesting byways. I was glad that none of my teachers said, oh, that's ridiculous, and let me wander. So if you stay for a time in the world of sense impressions and bodily sensations, or the unborn world, as it's often called, you have a shot at seeing your original face, the face before social conditioning, the moment before your ancient twisted karma takes over, and you start chattering and eating and flirting and all the things that you do. So this is why we practiced living from the point of view of not knowing yesterday. A whole day, 6 or 7 or 8 hours of just body awareness. You need to set aside a day to do that because it's very hard to do. That has to be your whole focus. So it was good that so many people were willing to live that way. At the very least, there was no harm done by those people yesterday. They couldn't get out and ruin other people's lives. So, let's see. Blah, blah, blah. So, if you practice, and you observe that the results of your practice are that you continue to make people suffer, then you have to actually question your intention or your approach. And I really advise students to be experimental. Sometimes people ask me questions that have, you know, choices involved. Many questions are like this. People say, well, should I do this or that? Well, how would I know? You know, I mean, the answer to me is try this, try that. You know, nobody else can have your experiences for you. And you learn so much if you're the one trying them out. So I think that this, and then be open to whatever happens. Like, I've told you guys a million times. In fact, I'm even sick of this story, so never mind. But if you're going to try to do something, you know, consequential in your behavior, like have temper tantrum whenever you feel angry, just to see what will happen, you have to be prepared to accept the consequences from the get-go, and that's part of the learning. I'm always wondering, gee, I'm noticing people who have rages always get their way. Well, I want some of that, you know. So I tried that for a while, you know. I mean, I saw what happens. Yes, you get your way, but nobody ever wants to be around you again. So you have to keep getting your way with different people. So you also have to be open for the completely unexpected. A student was telling me that she, in this certain situation with her ex-husband, and their lawyer. Anyway, they've been divorced for some time, but they have this division of things and children that involves that they get together every once in a while and talk about it. And she says always she's so ashamed of her behavior in these situations because her husband and their lawyer always, you know, like kind of strong arm her. And she feels like a child. They treat her like a child, and she falls into their definition. And then, so she's nasty to them in return. She just won't cooperate whatever he wants. She always is hard to deal with. And this is because she feels like it's her only power play. Well, at one of these meetings, but she always has noticed her suffering around this, which I think is one of the best things you can do in a situation that where you're helpless and out of control. Notice your suffering. That means you're putting in information that's going to be digested and, you know, is going to be fooled around with internally. So one day, you know, at this meeting, for no reason she could discern, she suddenly acted like an adult. They could not strong-arm her. They could not belittle her. They could not make her feel like a child. She acted like a reasonable adult, and she was very kind. And so she came out of there like, what happened? What happened? So you have to be open to the unexpected. Who knows what happened? Something happened, but, you know, maybe there's a million explanations. This is the trouble with cause and effect. Except in a science lab, you know, where you've got everything controlled. Out in the world, it's hard to talk about cause and effect because it's so complex. And we have a lot of superstitious behavior around that. So that's a particularly satisfying way when it's just time to change and your subconscious knows it. So continual practice means continual mindfulness, acknowledging seeds that lead to greed, hate, and delusion, and letting them wither if you can. It takes tremendous patience because if you've had 40 years of conditioning, you can't expect it to go away so fast. You have to let the process have its own time. You just keep feeding in the suffering, acknowledging the suffering and the shame. If you've hurt someone, put that in there too. So this is where the effort belongs, in just maintaining your patience and maintaining your mindfulness. You don't need superhuman feats of concentration or psychic theatrics. It's just plain old boring mindfulness. And this is so disappointing to people. I have students, and a couple of times, with really bright, energetic, young students, a student will come. One came just a couple weeks ago and said, I've been practicing, you know, at Zen Center, and I'm now doing this and doing that. But they always put me on window washing detail. So I've washed all those little panes in that Buddha hall, you know, in that dining room so many times, and I have so much energy. And I think I need more responsibility, she said. So I said, no, just do the window panes. You know. So then she comes the following week. She said, well, I did the window panes and I didn't get enlightened. I mean, I'm summarizing what she said, but that was basically her complaint. She said, I need more to do. I know how to do the windows and everything. And I said, well, clearly you're not doing them wholeheartedly. If you're doing them with complaint and resentment, you're not giving yourself to the windows. She goes, but that's what it requires, to do it and do it and do it until you can give yourself more and more and more, more and more and more, until all of you does the windows, all of you puts these chairs back after the meeting. Not you get them done so you can go home to bed. You put them back. Those are minutes of your life, putting the chairs back. It's just as valuable as anything you've ever done, because you're doing it. That's why it is. There's no esoteric reason. It's valuable because you're doing it. So, gee, I must have missed a couple pages. I wanted to tell you something. Well, you know, you can train yourself and guide yourself. Oh, here it is. You know, my grandson, 10 years old, he's half black, and he lives with his black family sometimes, and it's a really different culture from our middle class culture. And he and I, we guide each other. I like to take him to have experiences that he doesn't have day to day. So I was invited by a student to this really posh art opening downtown in the financial district of San Francisco, catered with exquisite food, a wine table. You know, this is to sell all these very expensive pieces of art. So I took him along. He likes art. So I said, we're going down on the bus, and I said, Anthony, let me explain about how you're supposed to behave tonight. I said, don't hang out near the food table all the time. Sometimes go away, then you can come back. And all the artists will be there with their work, so go up and look at the work of each artist and then feel how the artist feels to you and ask him questions or her questions about their art. And I said, what's most important is for you to feel how you feel about the art, and then you can ask good questions. Okay, Grandma. Okay, so we get there. He does exactly what I ask him. He takes food from here, eats it, then goes to another table, another table, and then goes around to the artist. And I'm watching him, and he's having incredible conversations with the artist. And pretty soon, I'm saying, let's leave, let's leave. He's got a crowd of adults around him asking him where he goes to school and everything. I mean, it's incredible. He totally felt his way into that. I overheard what he said to this one woman, you know, who was drawing, doing a combination of collage and photography. He says, oh, plants, huh? Plants. and he asks her why she cut the stems off here and put something else on. Oh, she's totally into telling him. Great, wild success. And then he returns the favor. One night, I took him to the movies, and I didn't think about how it was going to be dark when we got out, and the street was completely different when the movie ended. We got out, and it's now filled with tons of black people, you know, jiving over here and calling to each other over there, and all eyes are on me. You know, the old white lady with the purse and everything. And Anthony just took my hand. He took my hand in this very masterful way, 10 years old. he took my hand and we're walking to the car and he says, "Hi man, how you doing? Hey bro, how are you? Walks me to the car, we get in. So this is understanding what's required of a situation, of being whatever is there. So I'd like to stop now, and I'll continue tomorrow night about this and develop it some more, but I'd like to hear your comments and questions before we break for the night. Anybody have any comments or questions? Yes.
You started to talking about body-to-body consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But from your talk, I only got this body consciousness. Where was the other body? Did I miss it completely? I'm sorry.
Well, maybe it was by implication, but with the some of the examples I used, yes, you can be aware of yourself internally. You should be aware of yourself internally, but there's no separation. If you actually have the experience, you have the experience of everything. There, it's quite arbitrary what's inside and what's outside. Like I said yesterday, Suzuki Roshi said that when you look at the moon is in your eyes. From a practice point of view, the moon is in your eyes. There's no reason to assume there's an object out there that you are viewing. In fact, from a practice point of view, it's much more helpful to assume that you have created the moon on your own eyeballs. So it's quite arbitrary what we call inside and outside. Mm-hmm. Did I see a hand over here?
Could you talk a little bit more about intention?
You mean in general, in practice?
In practice, because it sounds like your own experience would lead you to a very simple intention. And I've noticed that my intention sort of changes with the situation.
Mm-hmm. What part of what I said implied a simple intention?
Well, maybe not simple in the sense of easy, but simple in the sense of focusing on what your body is.
Oh, right, yes. Well, the effort to do that is not simple. But I think that you're quite right that intention changes in the situation. But where does it come from? Where does the intention come from? It arises somehow. And part of trust over a lifetime of practice or over a year or a day of practice is, you know, I was thinking about how people defer to authority. I was thinking about this, you know, just in general, and I wonder now, why would a person defer to authority if it contradicts your own body feeling? And I think it's because, for me, I have done that when I thought the body feeling wasn't deep enough. That whatever was arising was not my deepest part. And then I'm confused. And so the authority has a chance to get in there and in my confusion. But if you kind of clear the path and you're aware of your deepest values or whatever is coming up in a situation is the best you can do, even if it's not particularly deep. I mean, maybe you're confused, chronically confused, and this is this level rather than this level is how it is now. There still can be some trust in that if you're familiar with these levels. So you begin to trust your own intention in a situation. But you'll sometimes be wrong. you know, I have an intention, you know, to be kind, but lots of things override it. Lots of things that I don't trust. And then it's back to the old drawing board. Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, Brian.
Easier is the right word, but it's not the word that comes to mind. Is it easier for someone of his age to make the appropriate response because he doesn't have all this accumulated baggage of, well, paralysis? What's society telling me I should do? What are people going to think if I act in a certain way? All this stuff that we accumulate as we age.
I think 10 is already adult-like, right? And this child in particular has so much anxiety that he can hardly do anything.
So I guess the other part of my question is, to what do you attribute that he acted so skillfully in both of those situations?
I think he was very concerned for me.
Yeah.
And I think he was having fun at the art opening. I mean, just, there was no investment in it for him, except to do as I asked. And then he began to have his own reinforcement as people responded so positively to him. I mean, this is just guesswork. And so I think pretty early we get, we lose our original face, pretty early. Maybe the minute we turn toward our mother's breast. Yes. Anything else? Yes.
You mentioned about your theories, and I'm wondering how those shaped your practice when you had the theories.
They shaped it a lot. So when I thought it was just magical, I left it alone. I didn't try to make my practice a certain way. But I did. I was pretty passive. I mean, when I look back, I was pretty passive. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. We can never say. I mean, it's pretty. If you don't have a goal, it's kind of hard to say, well, I should have done this, I should have done that. I did suffer tremendously, but because I imagined that I just would never, ever have any peace of mind. And I thought all this effort and no peace. You know, I thought that a lot. And then when I thought it was about balance, that's when I felt competent. You know, because you can balance things. You know, and I felt like I had carte blanche to make my life, you know, comfortable and in control. And then when I thought it was about self-acceptance, then I just indulged myself, you know, allowed myself to do everything that I did. And when that didn't work out so well for other people, I thought, well, they have to accept me the way I am, which is true anyway. And I guess the reason that I'm back to magical thinking is because it's just so vast. It's just so vast. How could I or anyone else ever think that they had any handle on anything? So, you know, we have this little scope or this little area of competence about like this, you know, and that's actually comforting to me now.
So would you say you've come, magical has a little bit of there's something different about it now than there was when you started?
Like mountains and rivers. Well, I certainly am not suffering over not having peace of mind. I pretty much accept that. In fact, I don't even want it. This seems more interesting. Thank you. Yes.
At some point, you know, you seem to fuse what you're thinking, what you are, you know, what you're theorizing, to something that goes inside. And there's a fusion of your mind and your feeling and your heart. And have you noticed any, or is there anything that, any guidance that you can give in terms of making that fusion happen? I mean, we can sit down and listen and intellectualize on a lot of things and think about plans and think about theories.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, it has to, maybe through the experience of what you're trying, through trial and error, but at some point that it goes inside, it goes deeper into the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think
the person changes.
I think sitting takes care of it. Because I think you need tremendous stability to absorb suffering. And I think that sitting does it. And you need tremendous stability to look. To look. You can't see anything when you're dodging bullets, you know. You have to take the bullet. You have to be stable enough to do that. The emotional and psychic stability that sitting develops is tremendous. You can be very, as I said yesterday, you can be very adventurous emotionally if you have some sitting experience. You can get married. Is there anything else before we part? Thank you so much.